Have you seen those new mics where like you're supposed to hold them right on your lips? You hold them like.
Can you hear him? Say what you had for breakfast, even if it's a lie.
Yeah, I just had a little cappuccino, sunny LA.
Yeah. You know, it is. Like, it's a whole vignette.
Yeah.
Right there. Welcome to this week's episode of Smart Mouth, the podcast where we find out more about our favorite people via their favorite food. And this week, our guest is Chef Marcus Samuelson. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
Good.
Yeah.
So right now, you just came out recently with your latest cookbook, the Red Rooster cookbook.
Yeah, the cookbook. It took me 4 years to do.
That's a long time.
It's a long time, but it's also... Beyond a cookbook is also a window in to this magical neighborhood that I call home, Harlem, and introducing a lot of the characters that were groundbreaking in that community, like Mr. Style himself, Dapper Dan, or, you know, Thelma Golden talks about art, but also more than anything talks about the magical people of Harlem.
I like this new trend in cookbooks where it's not just recipes. They tell bigger stories than that. And
well,
I feel like yours does
that
too.
When you work on something for 4 years, you can't really you miss every trend there is. You know,
right.
Kale came and Brussels came out, and you know, pork belly left. So this trend has been going on for me for about, you know, 12. I've lived in Harlem for 12 years, and I also felt it was important to document sort of the struggle and the hustle of opening a restaurant in this very time, in this very moment, and paying homage to people that lived there before, but also not creating a time warp, something very contemporary and new. So the book talks about that. It actually starts, I don't know if trendy cookbook starts like that, but it starts with me being robbed.
I saw that.
Yes.
And I thought that was a really interesting way to start a cookbook, especially because I think people think of cookbooks as being very gentle. This is us at the marble countertop. And you're like,
Martha's book would start like that.
Yeah.
You know, but this ain't Martha's book. I love Martha. This is not Martha's book. I was held up. And, you know, but it was more than being held up, was also I wanted for people to feel and see that when you're an immigrant, until you have your papers, not like you've done illegal stuff, but you're waiting for your papers. And any given day, one little type of screw up can change everything. And I was at the time a 3-star chef in New York. So from the outside looking in, it was very successful. But yet, until you have your damn papers, you feel very insecure about the whole situation.
Okay.
And I didn't really care about the money he took. I more cared about, give me my goddamn papers.
Yeah. And you were born in Ethiopia. And so you talk about Ethiopian food a fair amount.
So do you. He's slightly blonder than the average Ethiopian, but I'm also slightly darker than the average Swede. So
yes.
We do have that in common.
Yes, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about Ethiopian food, because I feel like maybe some of my listeners won't be totally familiar with it. Some of the basics is injera. That's the sourdough made from teff.
Yeah. So, I mean, being here in LA, you actually have a great little Ethiopia that, you know, and I think that one of the best ways of communities like that, they just post up and people got to drive through them, but then also every now and then get off that bus, car, whatever, and taste and smell something different. And when you get out and you eat an Ethiopian restaurant here or in Washington, D.C., you know, what you will taste, which is our staple, is the injera bread, which is a sourdough pancake made with one of the oldest grains in the world called teff. And you want that teff to be really dark and sour and tangy. And then most of the Ethiopian food is actually vegetarian-based.
Right, right.
So when you do have the chance to eat one of the bigger sort of festive dishes, which is dorewat, which is chicken stew, or kitfu, which is the beef stew, beef tartare, warm beef tartare.
Before we get into that, I wanted to ask a question because I saw a few references in my research to coffee with butter. Serving it with butter is traditionally...
Yeah. So this food you're talking about is really coming from... First of all, Ethiopian food is a couple of things, right? It's very much connected to spirituality, right? Which means that you're fasting about 200 days out of the year, 220 or something like that. And also it's tribal, right? So I am from the Asmara tribe. Amhara tribe, and my wife is from the Garage tribe. And these two things that you're talking about is actually from Garage.
Right.
Kitfu come from her tribe. And also coffee, when you add butter into it, comes from her tribe. And essentially the butter, you know, like these things are, you know, coffee's been in the West maybe for 400 years, 350 years.
Sure.
It's been in Ethiopia for thousands and thousands of years.
Right.
And, you know, fermenting butter, which is both a necessity, but it's also a flavor enhancer. So you use butter for so many things. So adding in that fat, that level of fat that we think about as cream, you know, makes sense.
So let's move on to the dish of the day, beef kitfo, which you had mentioned that a lot of Ethiopian food is vegetarian, but this is beef. And as you mentioned in your cookbook, it must be important to you because you served it at your wedding.
Yeah. I mean, again, food means... It's a window in, it's coding, it's a window into where you're from and what do you celebrate, and it's also like financial. So when we got married, you know, it wasn't like sending out invitation to the local Hilton, you know, it's like we were married out on the countryside where the whole tribe came, like 1,500 people show up. And the first thing my wife said is, I just want people to eat meat. Because that meant that, you know, it's not that often you can eat meat.
Okay.
So the slaughter process is very important. And then you use the whole animal. But the kitfo is very special. It's very labor intense. You chop the meat. And then, again, it's a tartar, but it's a warm tartar, which makes it so sexy and delicious in a way. Because that butter, once that butter sort of hits the pan, and you just take it off the heat and you just toss it ever so slightly. And then you dip it in this, I would say this berbere with a little bit of fat to it. It is one of the most delicious dishes you can ever eat.
Wow.
Yeah.
You say it's like a tartare, but that it's a little bit cooked.
It is, exactly. So it's, you can order it now, like sort of cooked well done, where cooked medium rare, like in a sophisticated restaurant, but it's really meant to be. So imagine you heat up a pan, you put in some butter, and then you add in a little bit of chopped shallots and some of the spices, some of the berbere. Simmer that for like 3-4 minutes, then take it off the heat, and that's when you hit the pan with the meat. And you just toss a couple of times, add in salt, maybe a little bit of mustard, pull it off, done.
Okay.
Get your injera out, get your injera game on, and start scoop. Start scooping.
That sounds amazing.
We need to give a shout out to this studio because my ugly bag, traveling bag, is actually now the mixing table.
It is.
I think that this is the world of a radio podcast done guerrilla style. I like it though.
Absolutely. It's definitely pretty much how we roll.
Yeah.
Suitcases, mixing table. Why not?
Why not?
Whatever works.
Very, very rad punk hip hop of you.
Well, speaking of punk, kind of, your recipe, it's not a standard muscle cut. You call for kidney or heart.
Yes.
And now, why'd you go that route?
Yeah, because of, again, this idea about eating meat. I mean, we have the best teeth in the world in America, yet we want everything to be soft.
Oh.
You know, that's just not how the world eats, you know?
Okay.
Like, if you get meat in Ethiopia or a larger part of the world, you use everything, and it's not called nose to tail. Like you just use it. But you're also not afraid of using other cuts that might not be so tender or might be a little bit different. So very often, you know, beef heart to me is this so beautiful, beautiful irony taste that if you chop it up and fold it in the very end, and beef heart has to be eaten medium rare. You can't cook it. You can't cook it well down because then it dents up and becomes like too... It doesn't work. It becomes rubbery. So if you want some flavor to the already flavorful beef tartare, chopping some beef heart, get in it, you know, like in, and it's just super delicious.
And then there's a sauce that you serve the kitfo with, awase.
Well, awase, it's like a dip. And, you know, what I love about this is when you read a menu, think about how much about food and language we learn through immigrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
Italian, Japanese, we learn sort of see the ice for sushi through that menu card.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing goes with Ethiopia, right? We learn this kitfo, kebe, injera. These are words that obviously mean something. And, you know, I would say this dip sauce that, you know, people make it a little bit different depending when they are, but it always has berbere, a spice blend, and then it has you know, could add in a little homemade hooch. You could add like a little whiskey into it. We stir it, right? So we preserve, it's also preserving technique, some acid, some vinegar or lemon. And then if you have olive oil or butter, and that's it. Fold in some butter, be fancy. If you want to be even fancier than that, why not some fresh herbs? And now you're a French Swedish chef.
There you go.
Yes.
And the Berberet is spicy, right?
Well, it is more like, it's not cayenne based. Mm-hmm. So we have a cayenne based called Mitmita.
Okay.
But the Berberet is, it's, imagine like a smoked paprika, just one step north of that.
Okay.
But then you also have cardamom, dry ginger, dry garlic. So it's very, it's flavorful, not spicy, I would say. Uh-huh. Because it's meant to be, eat lots of it. Right?
Okay.
It's not one thing you put a pinch in.
Got it. I see. Now, in Ethiopia, there's a tradition of eating raw meat, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's like restaurants that specialize in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Kitva houses, absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And did you go to a lot of those when you traveled to Ethiopia to do research?
I mean, it does help to have my wife, obviously being from the tribe, and her family, her mother, her sisters, and they're very opinionated about a lot of things. But that's great because also there's nothing, I mean, fermentation of the food, why, the culture of it, like, you know, when you're, you know, like me adopted, you're very removed from the full deep tissue culture.
Uh-huh.
And my wife has actually, you know, through her family, I've helped rediscover a way of cooking. And there's a why, right? Because a lot of this food came through war times when you needed to eat something, but you didn't want to tell your neighbor where you were. So it was all like raw food. So it's like the food is so coded. It's really cool.
Yeah. So that is a theory that I came across a number of times.
Yeah.
Part of the reason why you eat meat raw there is because you didn't want to be found out.
Yeah.
whether it's neighbors or even people you are at war with.
Yeah.
Perhaps. That's an interesting theory. Do you buy that theory?
It's a good story. And, you know, I think that, it's so long ago, but I'm sure, why not? And at, you know, Ethiopia in itself is just a magical country where it's such a rich history and food, you know, the misconception about Ethiopian food, you know, but I do think that Ethiopian food is probably the most successful food from the continent outside Africa, right? Because you have just in LA, maybe 25 restaurants. In DC, you have 200 in every major city in the country. And I think for Americans, they really learn it in through the college years because it's very communal and fun. And, you know, it's something, it's actually affordable and you can hang out with your friends. So, yeah.
In Seattle, there's a ton of Ethiopian restaurants all in the student district.
West Side. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, completely. Is it true that like little tiny children aren't allowed to eat the kitfo?
You know, kids in Ethiopia eat mostly vegetarian and mostly ashiro, chickpea, right?
Okay.
So the time where they eat kitfo, it's so rare because it's more like big occasion. So, and if they eat the kitfo, they eat it most of the time the cooked version. You know, because of course, like any you know, you need time to sort of deal with the different types of bacteria and all of this different stuff. So, yeah, so the cooked version, yes, but not the raw version.
Okay. Do you have a particular dish that you feel like has most of your heart in it, or is it just all of it is beloved by you?
Well, I mean, there's many things. I had a lot of respect for the bird. You know, I knew being in Harlem that I had to have a good fried chicken.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, my neighbor is Sylvia's, and she's been doing it for 52 years, 55 years. You have Charles pan fried chicken that is amazing. So I had a lot of respect and fear for it because I didn't grow up eating fried chicken.
Okay.
I'm a fish guy.
Okay.
You're right? I grew up eating fish cheeks and mackerel and stuff like that. So, you know, it wasn't actually until a lot of my friends were like, hey, man, just fry the damn bird. You're overthinking this shit. And it was actually John Legend that came up and said like, hey, Marcus, stop thinking about the fucking bird. You're overthinking it. I'm going to come up and fry it for you. And he came up and fried the first fried chicken.
Amazing.
At Red Rooster. So, but it was like, you know, like you're in a little bit of fear. And when you come into a community that you respect and love, it's not bad because you want to, for me, it came down to really, okay, bone in, thigh meat and legs, skin on. So it's really juicy. And then also the protecting the sound of the, you know, if you don't have the sound of chicken doesn't do that, that crispiness. And then the should be responded by juiciness just coming at you. and then you start to feel the heat from the, you know, the dried garlic and the chili powder and the sweetness on the lips.
Uh-huh.
If it doesn't do that, it's chicken, but it's not, you know, it's not Yardbird.
You want it to be a fully immersive experience.
Yes, absolutely. And it should stop. You think about like, oh, what the hell is this?
Okay.
That's our bird.
Okay. So you're here in LA to cook with Naisha Arrington.
Yeah,
Leona.
I'm very excited to cook with Naisha. I got to know Naisha first, actually, through Josiah. You know, and Josiah is always, for me, an iconic LA chef that, you know, when he taps and say like, hey, look at this person.
Uh-huh.
It's a good sign, you know?
Okay.
And then I worked with her before, and I love, there's something really cerebral and focused about Naisha that I always liked. And then she came over to Red Rooster and cooked with us. You know, we celebrated women of color, you know, great women, female chefs and in our restaurants, like Edna Lewis and Leah Chase. And we wanted to celebrate a contemporary Naisha. So, and it was fun to have her in our restaurants. And now I'm coming back to her.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. Do you know what you're going to cook?
Yeah, it's going to be, you know, it's at Leona's. It's going to be tonight. It's going to be a nice little taste menu for courses. But knowing Naisha, the recipe is just a guideline. She's probably going to take us out here to the ocean somewhere. So I got my swimsuit on. I'm ready.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
It literally is on the ocean. For anyone who hasn't been to Leona, you can see it from the front patio.
You can see Russia from the patio?
Yeah, probably.
Yes.
If you have special, special, special Republican eyesight, then yes.
You can do it.
Yeah, I think so. Have you had Ethiopian food in LA?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember any of your particular favorite restaurants? I know that we've got Mercado might be the only place where you can get raw kefo.
Yeah. I mean, I love that restaurant. I love the
little Ethiopian.
And then jumping back and forth. Mm-hmm. And but it's also the commute. I was here one time when it was like Ethiopia Day. So I was there on a parade, which was cool.
Very cool.
So that was really cool for me. And your kids and everybody, the whole community was out. And it's just nice that in the middle of the city you have this really sticky togetherness. And that's one of the things I love about LA. I think like the food scene through the lens of the immigrants in LA is just incredible. I don't know any food town like LA. And then, I mean, it's magical. Like K-Town is just magical.
Yeah.
Little Ethiopia, you know, I'm in love, deeply in love with the little mall sushi that you have. And we can never get that game in New York. We'd like to, but we can't.
How come you can't?
It's deep. It's deep tissue. I mean, it's
you guys. But I want to know.
But I think honestly, it boils down to you guys are just closer to Asian culture.
Sure. Yeah.
Not just geographically, but also the whole understanding of the culture, not just Japan, but all the other Asian culture that supports and understands it fully. And I mean, Vietnamese game is tied here, like, of course, Mexican. I just love the ethnic food scene in Los Angeles, all of it.
Yeah, we do a good job, I have to say.
Absolutely. And then you layer like farmers market and all that other stuff. But I'm more in love with the deep ethnic game.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm.
What does New York have that LA doesn't, though?
Oh, it's very different. Very, very different. I think, like, New York is more like, you know, the way Mozza, the way Nancy's restaurant, which is an incredible restaurant,
mm-hmm.
that's more New York restaurant, right? Very, you walk in, it's a big bar, it's very established, and it's, you know, the wine list is on point, and great service, and great food.
Yeah.
And I think Nancy, for me, is like the quintessential New York restaurant in LA.
Okay.
And I, you know, walking in and seeing her at the Mozza Bar, I'm just like, when I miss New York in LA, I go there, right?
I see, okay.
And I love it, and it's delicious, and she's the best host and chef. So, we have those type of restaurants, and it's closer to Europe in many ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's Italian-derived food.
But then the other thing that I think New York has that LA still doesn't really have in the same game is, like, being in restaurants in New York fucking matters. It matters. Like, it's sticky. Like, you get into a place, you walk into Red Rooster, you walk into a New York, you walk into Roberta's, or you walk into, you know, Stella, or you walk into a cool place in New York City, the room so-and-so is over there, so-and-so is over there.
Uh-huh.
And it matters. You know, like, LA is still driven by entertainment industry so much, so great food can be everywhere, but it's kind of like, it's still a little bit sort of, it doesn't have that level of energy because here you go up against the biggest stars in the world, right?
Right.
It's a completely different energy. It's kind of hard to describe,
okay.
You know, and energy, like Rooster's restaurants, it's built on energy. So if you don't have that stickiness, if you don't have the hat guy next to the downtown lawyer, next to the person that's trying to sell pies, or next to the person that, you know, this layer of myriad of diversity, true diversity, not money, but diversity, that level of energy, you need that. And people sort of almost flirt and be in each other's face at the same time.
Okay.
That's sticky. It's sweaty. I haven't seen that here yet.
Okay. Interesting. So you're saying like to actually be in a restaurant in Los Angeles is sort of more of a like lower energy experience?
Well, it's just different. I mean, you can't talk about a large city like that. So I don't want to just like.
Sure.
But if you're going to generalize, it is a different energy coming to a New York restaurant. That doesn't mean what you get on the plate is better or worse.
Okay.
It's just an energy level. And I do think it has to do a lot with that, you know, in New York, you go to a restaurant, that is like the big, it's a big, big deal. Here, you're up against the stars, you know what I mean?
Such
a different, and a lot of people eat in their homes and they do in-home catering.
Right.
That doesn't happen. If you're like, you're out in New York.
Right.
You're doing all that. And so you bring that level of energy when you're out too. Even, you know, people from Los Angeles, when they come to New York, they're not at home in their hotel. They're out.
Right, right.
In it.
Yeah.
And so restaurant doesn't work if you don't, if people just come there to eat, that's not what it's about.
Okay.
You know, no one comes to Red Rooster because they're hungry.
Well,
I mean, they will come to be seen and eat and be part of it and be, you know, that's an experience.
Okay.
So you need that. If we don't have the experience of our audience to participate, it's just...
So it's kind of dinner and a show that you're putting on.
Of course, but the customers are part of that, you know?
Okay. Interactive show.
Interactive, absolutely.
All right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Smart Mouth. Everybody, check out the Red Rooster Cookbook. And Marcus, thank you so much.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.